He took him away from his father's Torah. He's learning the Torah from Shane Weaver. Metaphysics. Took him away from Maisa Merkava. What could be a greater loss than that? What's the answer? The answer is like this. The point is like this. Point is, you see, people make a mistake. The average person, well, not really the average person, a person who is introduced to Torah, and the person who is even introduced to a sophisticated philosophical approach in Torah, still, nevertheless, usually makes one mistake. The big mistake is that they attach the same emotions that they had towards the other things to Torah. See? What they're doing is like this. They, instead of saying that the good is money, now the good is knowing a Masechta. See? But they fail to realize one thing. They really haven't gone too far. Because they're just substituting one thing for another. In terms of their emotions, they aren't really on a different level. All they're doing is, they're taking something, you know, which granted is certainly a better thing, and they're substituting it for they're taking Torah and they're substituting it for materialism. But the truth of the matter is that they relate to Torah now in the same way that they related to materialism. They really haven't changed. Do you know what I mean? The relationship is precisely the same. And since it's precisely the same, they really haven't improved themselves very much. The thing that they fail to understand is that the relationship to Torah or to a more perfect way of life has to be a different relationship, not just the object of the relationship, but the very relationship is different. You see? Now, what the Rambam says is like this. When the Rambam says that nobody can harm you, what he means is that the only value that there is in this life is perfection. Perfection really is the only thing that will give a person happiness, nothing else. And perfection is something which demands a different kind of relationship. If a person feels that he wants to be a great goyin, because he wants to have this, he should know he's operating on the same level as the person who's after money. The only difference is he's substituting one thing for another. Perfection demands that the person has no desire to achieve, you see. He has no desire for achievement or for conquest, you see, or for accomplishment. Or for acquisition. You see? He doesn't have any of these desires. All these desires are gone. He recognizes, on the contrary, that there is no purpose and there is no benefit in the acquisition. There will be no benefit if he could sit down and reflect, I am a great gadol. I know the Masechta. I am a great goyim. You see? As long as he feels that there is some great benefit, some emotional gain that he's going to get from being this great goyim, he still is operating on the same level as the other person who's a materialist. See? A person who is really on the high level, philosophical level, is not concerned. Not concerned. If he happens to be a goyin, it's fine. If he's not a goyin, it's the same thing. Doesn't make a difference then. See? Chazal say in Brachas that the Gemara says, I forgot the names of Tanai, I think it was when they went to visit a certain Tana that was very sick, and he was dying. Was Rabbi Yochanan? He was dying, and he told him. He said he was crying. So he says, "Why are you crying?" He says, "If you're crying because you feel you didn't learn enough Torah in your life, echad amar ba vechad amamet. Whether you learn more, whether you learn less, doesn't matter. What do you mean whether you learn more? What does the Gemara mean there? Whether you learn more, whether you learn less? The Gemara should say that it makes no difference if I wasted an hour or if I didn't waste an hour. It's absurd. One word of Torah, Yerushalmi says, is worth more than all the mitzvahs, all the kiyama mitzvahs. So how can you say that the Gemara is saying, learn a little more, learn a little less? What do you mean? The answer is like this. The answer is that a real chacham recognizes the truth of the matter is it doesn't really matter whether you learned another blot or not. The universe doesn't depend upon that. As long as a person is so involved in his own self-importance that he thinks if he got another, he learned another few blot, that this is going to make the big difference, then he's still involved in it. He has never removed himself from his egomania. You see? Hasn't removed himself from his... He's not that important in the universe. He doesn't recognize his place. Whether he learned another blot or not doesn't make any difference. The only thing that he has, the only thing a person has in this world is that he can... A person can live in a way which is most beneficial to him and to others, you see. He can live in a way which will lend itself to his happiness. But the perfection demands that that happiness is in the way he relates to certain activities, not to accomplishments. You know what I mean? In other words, if a person would underestimate the activity of learning, then he'd be wrong. He'd be wrong. But the accomplishment of learning, you see, the conquest of learning, that definitely has no value. That's what he told him. He says, what are you crying about? If you're crying by the fact that you didn't learn enough, you could have learned more, you're a perfected person. You're not egocentric. You learned a little less, a few less svaras, a few more svaras. What difference does it make? As long as your relationship to learning was the correct one, and that, you know, it was. So what if a person has a life where they can't really learn that much Torah? A situation such that they can't learn that much Torah doesn't mean he's less perfected, you see. As long as his relationship to Torah is such, as long as his relationship to Torah is such as that he wouldn't waste his time away. If a person would have wasted his time away, he would have said, well, what if I learn a little less? See, that shows you he doesn't recognize the activity of learning. You understand what I mean? There's learning in terms of activity, there's learning in terms of possession and conquest. So if a person would say, what difference does it make if I learn now or not? It means to say that he doesn't recognize learning as a valuable activity, because if that really is the proper activity, then he would be doing it. You see. But if a person, that doesn't mean that the person recognizes it in terms of what he accomplished, not in terms of accomplishment. It's a relationship. Perfection demands that a person should not treat learning and treat the areas the metaphysical areas as if in the same manner as he treats the physical areas. That's why Chazal say, for instance, Alocha, that a person that's terasom naso is patur min ha-mitzvahs. And the Rush says, what does it mean terasom naso? It doesn't mean a person's learning all the time. The Rush says, even if a person is busy and he's preoccupied, he can't free himself, but every free minute he has, he learns, he says that's terasom naso. He's on the same level. He's on the same level of perfection. It's a relationship. You see, that is perfection. You know, like the Rambam, that's right, like the Rambam at the end of his life, he couldn't learn. He had to do for Claudius Yisrael, and he didn't have time to learn. That's right, was he any less perfect? No, on the contrary. That was a part of his perfection, that he recognized that now is not the time. So the Rambam could have learned in his life, with him to learn for 1 hour, to work out svaras. Can imagine the type of svaras he'd work out. But he wasn't egocentric. He recognized that this is the situation. Now is not the time to learn masvaras. Now is not the time to. I can't help myself. This is a situation. Ashgacha had it worked out in such a way. This is what I have to do. You see. Now the thing is like this: that a person who is of such a philosophy and doesn't feel possessive about his learning, about his Torah, no matter what occurs, he will never feel that he has to take revenge, because revenge stems from the fact that a person isolates a certain entity as the good, whatever it might be, even if it's ruchnius. If he is, as soon as he isolates that entity as the good, he's going to say, well, somebody could take it away from me. Truth of the matter is that nobody could take it away from you, because real perfection is a certain state of mind. That's what it is. It's a certain state of mind. Learning is an expression that stems from that state of mind, but the state of mind is the perfection. Since the state of mind is the perfection, nobody can really harm you. A person who is perfected does not care to have perfection. The fact that a person cares and desires perfection, and desires to be perfect, desires to possess certain things, spiritual qualities, is the greatest imperfection. Do you understand what I mean? It comes out a very strange phenomenon with perfection. Perfection comes out that those who search it out, by searching it out and desiring it, are the imperfect people. It would seem that God created a world in which that which is considered the ultimate state and the best thing to have, you can never get it. Because if you try to get it, the mere trying itself is going to cause you, you're evading the results. You know what I mean? That you're canceling yourself out by trying. How am I supposed to get it? Okay. What's the answer? Because, like I say, even if it's true, even if you care for yourself, even if you want to do it because that's the best thing for you, but you want to have this enjoyment, you want to have this happiness, That itself is an imperfection. That itself is an imperfection. See, the real perfected person is not concerned with himself. Real perfected person, like the Ram says, Kichol Asahava Ani. He's completely involved in he's completely involved in an external world, in Avas Hashem, in a metaphysical world. He's very unimportant. He's very unimportant. The self is unimportant. There's a loss of the self. As long as a person has the strivings of the self, he is in an imperfect state of necessity. Of necessity. What? Yes. So Rasul Slant says, why Lo'ilam? So he says Lo'ilam is because there's no other way. It's impossible any other way. Truth of the matter, that's the way it is. See, the thing is like this, that a rational person will always want to be in the best state. So the truth of the matter is that the reason why he goes after perfection is because he wants to be in the best state. And it is the best state. No question about it. But the thing is that what happens is, see, perfection, you cannot really achieve perfection directly. You can do certain things and put yourself on a certain road where perfection can happen upon you. You know what I mean? That's the only thing a person can do. Exactly. It can happen to you. But the only thing you could do is you could put yourself on the road or in that situation where it can happen. You see? That's the only way that it can occur. Putting yourself on the road might be a lo lishma. It is a lo lishma. It is a lo lishma. But it is the only way that you could ever reach that situation. It's like I mentioned many times that Einstein said that a person starts thinking because of a practical reason, practical considerations. He says, but then he gets so overawed by the thought that becomes the end in itself. See? That's right. That's exactly the way it works. See, that's right. But when it comes to the Lasikom, if a person, that's an imperfection. That's an imperfection. If a person will say that it's because he desires, he wants to have learning. That itself is an imperfection. You see? That itself is an imperfection. Of course, I just want to warn you against one thing. A person will say, well, look, I'm not so interested in learning. I'm not so imperfect. You know? Very perfected person, you know? A person has to work the desire that he has to achieve happiness. He has to work with that desire. He has to work with it. He has no choice. So the only intelligent thing is to work with the desire in a way where you really be in a situation where you have happiness. But when you reach that situation, you won't be concerned with it anymore. You see, that's the way it works. That's perfection. See, that's perfection. What Yesu said, Hasachas Elokim Ani, meant like this. In terms of the personal relationships, I'm not involved in that at all. So the only thing that a person can be involved in, if he's a perfected individual, is trying to bring about something which is in line with the Ashgacha, because of Avas Hashem. That Asachas Elokimani.
That means that the Asachas Elokimani means in that area we have to rely on the Ashgacha. In that area, I can't read the Ashgacha. That's what he said. So therefore, there's no way that I could ever, it could even enter my mind that I should try to destroy you for the benefit of the Ashgacha, because I can't read the Ashgacha. A person can't read the Ashgacha. That's what he meant. Okay. So therefore, what he was saying was essentially the person should only operate. See, a person should only, in terms of the personal, he's not in that area. Then the only thing is that in terms of perfection, a person should try to bring about the good, right? That, and so far as that's concerned, we can't read the Ashgacha. So that's why you have a guarantee I'll never do anything, take any steps against you. Yeah, so that explains also why in the beginning when what Yesus told them. He said, So he doesn't mention that you didn't do anything bad, or Michael, you doesn't mention anything about that. So he goes, really he was speaking in terms of his framework of reality, that he wasn't involved in the personal, and so far as Yashgach is concerned, this was the best thing. So, but they didn't pick it up at that time. At that time, he was just—that's what he thought. So he was speaking in his own framework. He never—that was it. But then later, he saw that they didn't understand. So therefore, in the second time, he had to explain to them. First time, he was saying the truth the way he saw it, the way he lived, but he wasn't trying to explain it to them. You see, he wasn't trying to explain to them that he's not going to take revenge. Second time, he saw they didn't understand what he was talking about. They didn't understand his framework, so it was necessary for him to explain to them what his framework is, and that in his framework there is the greatest guarantee that he will not take revenge. Hey, Rashi fits in very nicely too. Rashi says that the 10 and the 1, take a look at Rashi over there. That, what he means is that Yosef said that he can't read the Hashgacha. Okay. Now, one more point I want to make is, like I said, if that's the case, so it comes out that the Losik and Losita is a tremendous, is a mitzvah that's on a, for a person at a very high level. Right? So, how come the mitzvah is given to everybody? I mean, it's a person has to be on a tremendously high level. He has to know that everything is Havlei Hazman. I mean, how many people can do that? So how can the Torah be Mechayev every person in something which is dependent upon great philosophical perfection? And the Rambam just spouts it out like it's nothing. Of course, for the Rambam, it's nothing. So the answer is this. The answer is that that sometimes a person does not partake of perfection, but he has to do certain actions to remind him of what perfection is. You see? To be aware of the perfection. So that's the pshat Losikam Losittar. His shoe is not on the level, but when he keeps Losikam Losittar, he will recognize at least what the true reality is. At least there's a momentary recognition of the reality there. The Ram here involved in Avos. So the Ram says kishtaayv lo taayv al midei secha, which means that you have to recognize that your own character traits are not the absolute. See, that's the point that most people stop at. They feel that the way their particular personality is developed, that's the absolute personality. See. And they kind of recognize that it's just the superficial personality features. It's not really the essence that they're dealing with. So therefore they can't even imagine working with another framework. I mean, why should I work with this framework? I'm so happy that I have this framework. This is my very essence and cause for my superiority. But if a person has a deeper understanding, then they recognize that we all have our own particular emotional characteristics, and that's not our essence. And if I'm working with somebody else, I might have to switch. I might have to work within the framework of his characteristics. And that's the only way the Rambam says that you can secure a friendship. He says, "V'omnon tayv amidus alvecha." He says, "U'kishiyachavin kolechod mishnei ahuvim alzos hatzavo yiyakavonas kolechod mishneim lahofik ritzon chavero v'yiyakavonas shneim yachad." Okay. So that's what the Rambam says. That's the only way that you can have a friendship is, friendship can only work, really work in the long run, if it's based upon this recognition of the fact that my friend has another framework, and I must function within his framework in order to make sure that the friendship endures. That's what the Rambam says. Umatoiv Maimar Aristoteles. What Aristotle says is very beautiful. What does Aristotle say? Ha'ohuv Echladu. Now, how do you read this? Okay? What he says further. Okay? Ha'ohuv Echladu. That's the end of that. That's the end of that one. That's what he's quoting Aristotle. He says, Aristotle said was very beautiful, was Ohov Echadu. That, what does it mean, Ohov Echadu? You see? The translation over here is a little weak. He says like this. He has the better translation. Hayidid ho'acher ho'ata. Alright? Hayidid ho'acher ho'ata. He says like this. That you are your own friend. You see? That's what he says. You are your own friend. Goes on. And he classifies friends. Right? He's also from Aristotle. Va'ahuvim gimel minim. There are three types of friends. One is Oev Toelis. What does Oev Toelis mean? He likes gain, benefit. That's his purpose in the friendship. It's a personal gain. Then the next one is Ohev Menucha. What is that? Chover Hanoa. Chover Hanoa. Pleasure. Pleasure. That's right. Pleasure. And the last one the Rambam has is Ohev Maila. Oyev Mila. What is Oyev? Chover L'dvar Nala. Okay? All right, three types of friends. Chover L'dvar Nala, for a high purpose. The Rambam breaks up friendship into three categories. There's what? There's the Oyev Toelis. That means like a business partnership, where you're just in business together in order to have an external gain. Then you have Oev Menucha, where there's a mutual satisfaction from each other. It could either be like Zachar and Akeva, where there's mutual satisfaction from each other. It's pleasure, mutual pleasurability. Or else, the other type of mutual pleasurability is a confidant. A confidant. What the Rambam means is it doesn't matter whether it's on the physical level, like Zachar and Akeva, or on the psychological level, but it's mutual satisfaction, psychological mutual satisfaction, okay? Physical and psychological mutual satisfaction. Those are the two categories. The last case is Oiv Mila. Oiv Mila is where we both are friends together in order to achieve a higher purpose, greater good, right? So the questions that we raised was, first of all, why should the partnership be considered friends altogether? That's number one. Partnership shouldn't be considered friends because they're out after a gain. I mean, it's just a relationship. They have to relate to each other in order to achieve that gain. But there is no real friendship there. And the third case, where the relationship is based upon achieving a higher gain. What do I care if the nature of the gain is a higher one? But the fact remains that it's just like the partnership in order to achieve a certain external good, be it a physical good or be it a spiritual, metaphysical good. I mean, what difference does it make? In terms of friendship, it's the same thing. All right? Those are the questions. The Rambam in the last case, the Rambam says, the yirtze kol echod le'ozer l'chavero ba'agia tovu l'shneim yachad. That they both want that the good should be given, should be received, attained by both of them together. It's true, the good should be attained by both of them, right. But the question is, why does the Rambam slip that in the case of the last friendship? He could have said it in the first friendship too. And if they both want to become wealthy together, then this is the real good friendship. If one guy just wants to use the other guy, then it's not a good, great friendship. Why is it when it comes to the Dvar Nala, the Chavar L'Maila, right, that the Rambam says suddenly they both want it together? I'm going off on a tangent. As I'll say, Rebbe says, Harbe L'Manati Merabaisai, V'yesimihem Mechaverai, U'mitamide Yesimikulam. So why, if that's the case, I don't have a Rebbe, start right with a Talmidim. Some people try that method. What's the pshat? What he was saying was that there is a certain, you see, the real knowledge, true knowledge, is that which is related to the possessor of the knowledge in a certain way, a certain relationship there. It's like they tell a story about a philosopher who went to study, a person went to study by a great philosopher, and he came back after 10 years, and he was sleeping over in the woods. And there was a fire at night, and he lost all his books were burnt up. So the next day he got to the town, so they started asking him, well, what did you learn? I mean, 10 years he went away from town. What do you know? What do you learn? He says, my books got burnt up. I haven't got any more. I can't tell you. So they told him that. Or came to realize that a philosopher who's dependent upon his books for knowledge hasn't really become a philosopher. I mean, if the tape library burns up, you know, and you lack knowledge, you haven't got any knowledge, that's not really that's not really knowledge. Knowledge has to be something which is a part of the individual, you see? You can't, that's right. So, that's not Rambam, the Marne Vuchim. The Rambam says that there is a certain type of knowledge. Aristotle says that there's a certain type of metaphysical knowledge, the Rambam says, that doesn't depend upon memory. It's an unbelievable concept. And the Rambam says that this is what Chazal meant when they said the Talmudo Miskayim Biyado. See? Gemara says, Chazala says, Ashrei mi shebola kan v'talmud aliyah biyado. Happy is one who comes to the next world with his Talmud in his hands. So most people think it means that I should plaimshot. I mean, is that the person should chazar over all his Gemaras and all his Mishnayos, and he should know when he comes to the next world he knows all the he knows shas. You see, but the Rambam learns different shot. The Rambam learns that there's a certain type of metaphysical knowledge which a person does not need memory for. You see, it is a part of his soul. It becomes a part of his soul. He says, and that's what Chazal meant when they said Talmud Miskayim Biyado. Ashrei Mi Shebola Kan Talmud Biyado means that his soul is perfected with a type of knowledge that is doesn't need memory to rely on. It's not facts. It's not an aggregation of facts. It's actually a change in his soul. Yeah. All right. That's based upon the Aristotelian theory that the Rambam holds from is that I'm achdus amaskil vamuskal, the oneness of the perceiver and the perceived. All right. I think really a saying with Harbe lamadati merabosai, v'yosem ehem mechaveray mitalmid yosem mikulam means like this: the Chazal perceived that there is a perfection in the human soul through knowledge, but the perfection in the human soul through knowledge has to go through three stages. See, the first stage is where the soul recognizes the model of knowledge. That's the Rav. Without the Rav, everything's worthless. Because he doesn't have the model, you see. But then when he starts discussing with his chaverim, the soul partakes of it, it becomes embedded in the soul to a greater degree when he starts talking it over with somebody else. Because at first he was just the recipient, the passive recipient of the knowledge. You know what I mean? When he starts talking it out, speaking it over with somebody, so he becomes active with regard to the knowledge, and it becomes more a part of his soul. And the highest, when is he really kona? The Talmido means where he is creative in the area and produces ideas in the area. That's Talmido. That's when the knowledge really becomes the greatest, attains the greatest attachment, becomes more a part of a soul than ever. You see? That's what Rabbi Yehuda Nasi meant. That's the pshat. Beautiful maimon. Intellectual development. What real intellectual development is, you see? The cave over here, the Rambam doesn't mean just sexuality. Yeah, the Rambam means love. That's what the Rambam means. It means love, romantic love. Yeah. The approach of the Rambam here. Really. What is, there are two ways to break down friendship. One way is the way that we've been trying to break down friendship over here until now. The type of gain and the this, that, yeah. Friendship is a certain mutuality. Let's give a basic definition of friendship. A certain mutuality between two individuals. Right? Now, there's two ways to categorize the friendship. One way to categorize the friendship is by breaking down, classifying the mutuality, the nature of the mutuality. But if you remember correctly, we said that friendship is a mutuality between two individuals. So another way to break down friendship is with regard to the individuals. See? In other words, friendship is a relationship between two gavras. Right? So there's two ways to classify. One way is to classify in terms of the mutuality. What is the mutuality? But there's another way to classify friendship. How would you classify friendship? In terms of the gavras. In terms of the participants. How much participation there is in the friendship. Right? You see it? Now the Rambam says like this. In other words, you will have as much friendship as you have participation of the gavra in the friendship. Isn't that true? Right? Therefore, the Rambam says there are distinctly three levels. You see? Because when you look at a person, at a gavra, see, I want you to understand something. When the Rambam says about the partners,
The Rambam doesn't mean two partners that hate each other, and they're just out to make a buck. And at the end of the day, they just go by, they don't look at each other. That's not what the Rambam's talking about. That's not a friendship. That's not a friendship. That was a question. What kind of friendship is that? They're just using the guy. The Rambam's talking about partners where people are really together. They have a sense of togetherness, and they feel friendship towards each other. And they have a common bond and a common goal. What is the common bond and common goal? That's to achieve wealth and prosperity. That's what they're looking forward to, and that's what they want to share. The enjoyment of it, of the attainment of wealth. And they're very good friends. They like each other. I'm not talking about partners that hate each other. I'm talking about a friendship of partnership. Okay? That's why it's called friendship. But the Rambam is breaking it down differently. What is the Rambam saying? He says, in that there are different levels of friendship because there are different levels of involvement of the gavras in the friendship. So the Rambam says like this. How do we break down the level of the involvement of the gavra? Well, you have to know what the gavra consists of. You have to know what the gavra consists of. So the Rambam says like this. You see it? So the Rambam says like this. A gavra consists of different things. There is a gavra in relationship to his external needs. You see? That's one dimension of a person's life. His needs. Another dimension of a person's life is his emotions. That's even closer than his external needs, because that's more him. And the highest level of the gavra, the essence of the gavra, is what? Is the intellect. Yeah, the perfection. That part which involves itself in perfection. I don't mean the intellect, just the part that mechanically thinks. I mean the soul. The soul. So the Rambam is saying like this, that the person can be involved in three levels of friendship. Why is the most inferior level of friendship the partnership? Why is it the most inferior level? Because it is the least involvement of individuals insofar as the essence of man is concerned, because it's not his essence. Do you see? It's just an extraneous requirement, an extraneous need. It's like the Rambam says, a person who is a wealthy man doesn't really affect his essence. It is a perfection, he says. He considers it one of the four perfections. But it's not really not a real perfection. He says the same king can wake up the next day and discover that he lost his kingdom, and yet he's the same man as he was yesterday. Right? There's no essential difference. So when two people are involved in a partnership for making money, are their essences involved? The answer is no. It's not the essence that's involved, see? Because that's not, you haven't hit, the essence of man is not involved in friendship yet. See? When the emotions are involved, and that's the second group, romantic love, that's emotions, and also the confidant, psychological peace of mind, the psyche. There's a joining of the psyche, a mutuality in terms of the psyche. But is that the essence of man? So the essence is not involved. So the friendship cannot be, the friendship is not complete. Why isn't the friendship complete? Because the participants aren't fully participating. Why aren't they participating? Because you have their essence isn't involved. So it lacks for friendship. You see? The last level, the only friendship, the Rambam says, that's a real friendship, is the friendship in which you're involved. What are you involved for? Perfection. That's a mutuality of essences. Then you have the gavra is totally involved. And only then do you have real friendship. That's the breakdown of it. Nice? Just the tape, okay. So what the, so we're discussing now the second quote from Aristotle that the Rambam makes with regard to the categorization. Three types of friendship. By the way, that's found in Aristotle 8 in the Nicomachean Ethics, Book 8, Chapter 3. Okay? That's what the Rambam's quoting from. That there's three types of friendship. Okay. And Aristotle's sense was like this. That there is a certain friendship that is brought about, that is engendered by partnership. See, partnership can serve as a basis for friendship. Of course, in certain isolated instances, in certain instances, partners can hate each other. But under normal situations, partnership can lead to a friendship, can engender a friendship. So therefore, we have to say that there is something here more than just a partnership. Because we notice a certain kinship among partners. A certain commonality is developed, you see.
And therefore, therefore it's classified as a friendship. What you mentioned is a good point. In other words, this falls directly in line. As a matter of fact, directly in line with what we said before, that the Rambam says that in Kenei L'Chachover, you should pay the Chaver if you have to. You see, you should cater to his emotional needs. You know, he likes something which you dislike, is distasteful to you. Go out of your way, do what he wants. Why? Because over there, it's a recognition of essences. You see, in the highest level of friendship, it's a recognition of essences. So the psychological is only a secondary consideration. It's only a secondary consideration. You know what I mean? You're not really concerned with the psychological, so you'll forfeit. So let's say, for instance, he has certain psychological manifestations or actions which are distasteful to you. So you overlook them because you don't care. You're not interested. If your friendship is based upon the psychological, then of course, things that are distasteful to you, then you know, what's the sense of being friends with them? But if you have a deeper motive in your friendship, there's something deeper lying there. And what is that? That is the essences. Then you will forfeit the psychological satisfaction and the utility gain. Because you recognize that's not what you're friends for. You're friends for something more important. A deeper element. Okay? All right. Now, the first part. The first part, he says, that the statement of Aristotle, Matov Maim Aristo, the other friend is you. Okay? In Aristotle, that's in Book 9, Chapter 4, in Aristotle's Ethics, maintains that only a good man can have a friend. Only a really good man can have a friend. A person who is virtuous. So a person who is not virtuous cannot really have a friend. Because even if you show Aristotle, a wicked person that has a friend, he would tell you, that's not a friend. Man has to come face to face with his own soul and the turbulence that exists in his soul. So he is very very disturbed. So therefore Aristotle says that the wicked man surrounds himself with friends in order to distract himself. Like I mentioned with regard to Hitler, Yamach Shemai. Couldn't go to sleep till late at night and had to constantly be surrounded by an entourage because of the turbulence that he experienced in his own soul because of his wickedness. That's what Aristotle says. Yes. Okay. Now it's Elias. And having then it's Elias. Therefore, also such men, such men do not rejoice or grieve with themselves. For their soul is rent by faction, and one element in it, by reason of its wickedness, grieves when it abstains from certain acts, while the other part is pleased, and one draws them this way and the other that, as if they were pulling them in pieces. Beautiful description, huh? If a man cannot at the same time be pained and pleased, actually modern psychoanalysis shows that it's possible even simultaneously. He says if it can't be. Because he was turning towards the position that he could, but it's difficult to explain rationally. So he said, yes, at all events, after a short time, he is pained because he was pleased. And he could have wished that these things had not been pleasant to him, for bad men are laden with repentance. Therefore, the bad man does not seem to be amicably disposed even to himself, because there is nothing in him to love. So that if to be thus is the height of wretchedness, we should strain every nerve to avoid wickedness and should endeavor to be good. For so and only so can one be either friendly to oneself or a friend to another. Powerful piece, huh? Aristotle is the same as the Pasuk, V'arashoyim kayam nigrash. That really wickedness, see, people imagine that wickedness is something which is really good. You really want very much, because a person senses that he has desires for these things. So a person feels really, intuitively, that if he could only be wicked, he'd really be happy. You see? But the truth of the matter is that the human personality is not just a simple mechanism, that just following a wish is going to lead to the inner peace that a person is searching for. But on the contrary, The person who is wicked, the definition of the wicked person, is the person who is torn. Parts of him are torn asunder. One part is tearing him this way, another part is tearing him that way. He is not an individual who is at peace with himself. There is no harmony in his soul, only disharmony. Powerful forces are pulling him in different directions, and his rational mind is being corrupted by the power of his emotions and being subdued. His reality principle is being suppressed. You see, so that one part of him is really pulling one way, and the other way. That's what Aristotle says. Now Aristotle says like this. Yes. Raised, what really makes the wicked man torn? Is the wicked man torn because of a sense of guilt? You see? Or is the wicked man torn... If let's say we'd have a wicked man who has no conscience, would he be a happy man? That's the question. What do you say? Aristotle says no. Between the wicked man and the good man, after there is such a thing as psychological disturbances. That's not what Aristotle's discussing. That's psychology. Aristotle's discussing philosophy, philosophical disturbances, not psychological disturbances. It is true that there are people who have unconscious problems which make them very very miserable and very torn, you see. There are people who have neuroses and psychoses. Certainly these people are not wicked, and yet they're torn. There's no question about that. That's a psychological problem. But Aristotle is not discussing that's a psychological derangement, just like you have a physical problem. You see, it's a different thing. Aristotle's discussing philosophically, assuming that the psyche is healthy. Then he's discussing, well, now what? Now we have a wicked man with a healthy psyche. Will he be happy or not? What do you say? It's essentially between the wicked man and the good man. What is essentially the difference? I mean, okay, you'll tell me a person is a rusher because he did bad things. Yeah, it's fine. Those are the actions. But what really down deep is the difference between the good man and between the wicked man?
Acceptance of reality.
The good man is the one who accepts reality and who changes over his internal nature to be in line and conformity with reality and appreciates and enjoys that reality. You see, and is at peace with that reality. But the wicked man is driven by powerful forces which come in conflict with the reality which besets him, you see, which he finds. So what does he have to do? So he makes an attempt to bend the reality. But the truth of the matter is that ultimately these forces will never really compromise the reality, because these forces have no basis in reality. So therefore, as he progresses, you see, and the emotion becomes more powerful, he will become more and more at odds with reality. Not less, more. You see, at first he'll be happy with small achievements, small changes in reality. Then he'll expect larger changes. And with every change, he's not getting any happier, because on the contrary, the same emotion which prodded him to begin with is now enlarged. And the emotion is an attempt to achieve something which just does not fall in line with reality. So therefore, he has to be torn between suppressing parts of reality. No man could actually make reality fall in line with his wishes. I mean, that's an impossibility. It's basically an impossibility, because his wishes are based upon total fantasy. Reality is given a set of phenomena. So there's no way that he could really make it in line with it. So when he sees certain realities which disturb him, he has to suppress them. So the part of the mind that recognizes reality has got to be suppressed for the part of the mind that is under the sway of this compulsion, you see? So basically the wicked man, now why should a person live like that? Only one reason, because he's under the sway of a tremendous compulsion. A person's under the sway of a compulsion can never be defined as a happy individual. I mean, it's an impossibility. He's under a compulsive force which he has no knowledge of, which he doesn't understand, which is driving him, and which will never, by its very definition, achieve enough satisfaction to even have the satisfaction of the desire, because it has no basis in reality. It's completely an insane type of a quest. And that's why if you study the lives of those people who are under the influence of such a quest, you'll find that their lives are filled with misery, not with happiness. There are moments when they seem to be happy. But even those moments when they seem to be happy, when they have their victories, those victories are still based upon a suppression of reality. Because the happiness and the victory is not in the present victory, but it's in the fantasy of something which is non-existent. You see? And they're trying to convince themselves that this fantasy can become, can be, right, is going to come into reality. You see?
I think that's what
you study the lives of the wicked, you'll find that. You study the life of Hitler, Mauthausen, or other Napoleon, or the other ones, you'll find that there was not an enjoyable, peaceful, happy kind of life. Yes. Has to be that way. It has to be, because they're driven by an insane compulsion. You see? Driven by insanity. That's why the wicked are wretched. Now, the thing is like this.
Yes.
One thing, though. Why is it that a person feels that if he can only follow his tendencies, he'll be happy? The answer is because initially the tendencies appear in a very small form. And they say, if I can only have this, you see? If I can only have this, then I'll be happy. The truth of the matter is he doesn't recognize that that desire stems from something which is completely irrational and which will not be satisfied with this next little step that he thinks he's going to make. So all he could see is that next little step, thinking if he'd satisfy this next little step, he'd be happy. You see? But it's not true, because that's only a surface expression of what lies underneath. And what lies underneath is never going to be satisfied with that next little step. It has a much bigger goal, much bigger plans in mind. You see? And therefore, Chazal say that what does the Torah do, basically? What does the Torah do? The Torah teaches a person before the desire becomes to reaches a proportion where it's uncontrollable, to put it in line. A person shouldn't think that first little step that he's going to make is going to be his salvation, because he won't find salvation in that first step. He'll never be satisfied. What he has to do is to recognize this and to get it under control right then and there. And once the parts of his soul are in harmony, then he will have a good existence. But the only way he can achieve a good existence is by having the parts of his soul brought into harmony. Yes? A person like Hitler that required people around him, the Russia that Aristotle depicts over here, that requires people around him in order to forget himself, is not because of a sense of guilt. Like we said, Hitler, Yimach Shemo, didn't suffer from a guilt complex. But why does he have to have people around him? Because his fantasy, he recognizes that his fantasy is actually doesn't exist. And that fear that it doesn't exist, you see, and it's not real, it's not there, is his greatest nightmare, and it's his constant nightmare. And therefore he has to have people around him. What do the people do? The people around him exactly substantiate the fantasy that this is really so, you see. You are really the great person that you imagine that you are, you see. It caters to his egomania, see. Well, always convinced himself he's on some type of holy mission. It's one of the characteristics of every Russia. They think he's on a holy mission. You see? That removes right away any types of guilt. And, of course, naturally, the guilt, even though it's true that's based upon a suppression, and therefore some of the guilt is going to come through, is going to plague him also, but essentially what the great fear that he's under is that the fantasy that he is completely dominated by, it has no base in reality, and his reality principle senses this. Therefore, he has to have the people around him are very important, because the people around him always confirm the reality. In other words, is based upon people, not based upon the real reality, because he doesn't look at real reality. If he looked at real reality, he'd be destroyed. So the way he substantiates reality is by the numbers of people that accept his plan or his fantasy. See? And that becomes the reality. When he's away from them, he's fraught with the... Yeah, exactly. Because the evil man is not a man of reality. Okay? But how does he exist? He has to have some way of existing. So he has to create... There is a reality principle. He must relate his reality principle to something. What does he relate it to? He relates it to people. The reality, according to him, is as many people as he can convince, as it reinforces his fantasy. You understand what I mean? That's why you'll find one way you could know when you see a movement that is intent on getting everybody to conform to it. You should know that deep down they really doubt their own premises. Yes. Christianity itself. Christianity, why was Christianity so intent on convincing everybody, especially the Jew, that they're right? Because down deep, they sensed that there is no substantiation from reality for their ideas. So the only way for them to convince themselves that the fantasy is correct is by mass acceptance. Exactly. That's why they must have mass acceptance, especially from the Jew. It was the one from whom they from whom the source for their nonsense. Yeah. The difference between psychology and philosophy. See, psychologically, no psychologist would call Hitler technically insane. He wasn't an insane person. Well, if he was insane, he couldn't have done so much harm. Russia tries to convince himself through the multitudes that his reality is correct, whereas the good man exceeds and yields to reality and changes himself and puts himself in line with reality and appreciates, has a total appreciation of reality. Doesn't need anybody around him. He's very happy when he's alone with reality because he's in conformity with it. See? That's the difference. Plato mentions also that when the tyrant, ultimately, you take a person, like if you want to look into another life, you take another Russia, if you're interested in studying, you could read about his life too. You see, the craziness, they become beset with complete craziness, and they go through these purges, destroying people for the slightest mishap. Why? Because why are they so suspicious? Because down deep they themselves question the reality, and any little sign that somebody's not going along with this, you see, brings to mind the fear of the ultimate reality that this is not so. That person must be destroyed. Slightest little incident, see? That's why they go through their purges. See? That's why Plato describes it too: the life of the tyrant, in constant fear that. That he's going, and of course, then there's other fears that he himself is going to be overthrown. Because basically, he knows that the only reason that he's interested in this not his his God-sent mission, but it's basically his own desires. He knows others are ready to overthrow him. So therefore, Plato has a good description in the end of, I think, the 9th book or the 10th book of the Republic. Yeah, that's the way it is. And nevertheless, since Plato wrote that description, there's still many tyrants. Yes. Mechanisms through which reality reaches the mind have been totally destroyed. His eyes don't work, his hands don't work, his senses don't work anymore. That's psychotic. It's a different thing. Russia doesn't have that problem. Like this. So he says, therefore, how could a wicked person have a friend? Since friendship is an extension of the enjoyment and appreciation of oneself and love of oneself, he says a wicked person does not love himself. Because a wicked person is trying to escape from himself. So therefore, he certainly cannot have an appreciation in somebody else of himself. So why do the wicked really have friends? Only for one reason: to keep them away from themselves. What? I read one of the books that I read about Hitler, Yimach Shemai. They said that the concept of friendship was like totally alien to him. Friendship alone did not exist. See? Cannot exist. It's impossible. Now, what is real friendship, actually? Real friendship is based upon a certain appreciation of the self, of the inner self. And it's an extension of that appreciation to another individual who shares that same type of perfection. You see? It's an appreciation if a person appreciates, that's why Aristotle says only the good man can have a friend. If a person has an appreciation of himself, and he appreciates the way he is, you see, because he is at peace with reality and he is a good individual, and he sees that goodness in somebody else, he will be drawn to that also. You see, and he'll appreciate that same thing in somebody else. That's what the friendship is. See, friendship is an appreciation of something that we find within ourselves in somebody else. Yeah. Now, if we appreciate our own goodness, if a person has a soul that's in harmony, and he appreciates the harmony of a soul, when he sees that harmony in somebody else, he finds that he shares with that appreciation. It's an extension, it's like a reflection of his own, of an appreciation of the self. It's a remarkable phenomena, you see? Aristotle is defining a remarkable phenomena. It's a different type of concept, different concept of friendship altogether. You see, this type of friendship is only possible in the virtuous man, in a person who is at peace with himself. Most people aren't. So that's why most people don't even know what that type of friendship is. You see? About it, that the source is narcissistic. There's no question about it. But we're not discussing the source. That's for psychoanalysis. That's not for philosophy. Philosophy is just discussing the phenomena. That's what the phenomena is. The phenomena is that a human being is constructed in such a way that he, living a good, pleasant life, and the good, the virtuous, have pleasant lives and enjoy and appreciate the perfection of their souls. When they see that perfection in somebody else, there's an appreciation for it. You see, and they share. There's a certain sharing, a mutuality, and a sharing in that appreciation of the other individual. You see? That's what real friendship is. This is the only most enduring friendship. We'll see why. Next week we'll go a little further, see why it's the most enduring friendship. We'll go back to the other Aristotle. But this is what Aristotle meant by friendship. And it really is an interesting thing. There's a pasuk in the Torah. That mentions this concept. See?
What?
Mocha becomes, of course, more intelligible under the with this understanding, because it's an appreciation of the perfection in the other individual. So it's only possible on the highest level. Yes, but that's why the psychologists maintain it's an impossibility. It's an impossibility. Actually, Ramban says the lid doesn't mean the lid makes it weaker. It's not exactly kamecha. But the thing is like this. But nevertheless, within psychological friendships, of course, you'll see. We'll get back to see why psychological friendships is really hardly possible. Whereas in a true philosophical friendship, it gets very close to kamecha. But there's another pasuk in the Torah that I want to have in mind that seems to support this. That supports this view. What's the pasuk? In Tanakh, you see, the pasuk in Tanakh was when David HaMelech with Yonasan. When Yonasan died, and David HaMelech said the eulogy for Yonasan, eulogized Yonasan. So what did he say? That's right. He says, "No'amto avoscholi me'avas nashim," that your love was greater for me than the love of women. See. So, what? What is the pshat?
It
was like this. You see, Yonasan was a perfected individual. And David HaMelech enjoyed his friendship because he saw in his soul the perfection, a certain perfection and harmony. And he appreciated that harmony and perfection, the same harmony and perfection which he appreciated within himself. You see, that's the highest level of friendship. Avas Nashim is the category directly below. Avas Nashim is the friendship which is based upon pleasurability. That's why when David HaMelech said the kina, the eulogy for Yonasan, so what did he say? He said that only with Yonasan did he experience the highest level of friendship. You see? Nam Tavas Chulim Avas Nashim. It's the highest category. We always talk about the Ava, Shein et Lui, but the highest Ava, David Yonasan. Because there was a mutual appreciation of the perfection of each other's soul. You see, that's only possible with this virtue. Appreciation, only then can you have true friendship. It's an interesting thing. It's an appreciation of a beautiful human being. A human being that's not a necessary ingredient, but it's an appreciation of an individual who lives in a certain beautiful harmony, and you have an appreciation of that individual. That's the highest level. In Aristotle, that's book 8, chapter 3 of the Ethics. Aristotle says that the friendship that is most endures is the friendship between the good, because the friendship is based upon the good, the fact that they are good. And goodness is an enduring thing, so therefore it will be permanent. But if it's based upon utility, so then it's only as long as the utility remains, and utility changes with the tides. The same thing with pleasure. A person's pleasures change. His emotions change. So as it changes, so then the friendship dissolves. You see? But the one question that's blatant in Aristotle is where he says that the friendship of the good is friendship for the sake of the person who is good himself. You see? Why? What does that mean? I mean, if that means, that's the problem. If that means If you're going to say that it's... Why should that be more for the sake of the person himself than if it's utility or pleasure? And why should it be any different? Friendship towards an individual is based on the fact that he is good, then I really am his friend inherently. I really like him. You see? But if it's because he supplies me with a pleasure, then I don't really care for him, I only care for the pleasure. I mean, why don't I say that in the case of the good also, it's for the benefit of the... it's for my benefit. I mean, why by the... it's for my benefit, the gain that I... the friendship, a friendship has to involve a gain? What kind of a friendship is it that he just likes this person because he's good? I mean, there must be something that he gains from the friendship. I could see why it's more enduring. It's more enduring because we will say that that which it is based on lasts. The nature of if a person has reached a level where he is good, so he will always remain good because that's a certain perfection that once a person achieves it, he doesn't lose. That we can understand and we can accept. But why should that type of friendship mean be more for the sake of the person than the friendship of pleasantness? I mean, in both cases, in all cases, we should say, it is the purpose of the friendship is for the one who is the friend. That's this for himself. I mean, why? He just wants to admire somebody as good, so let him read about somebody in history and admire him. Why does he have to have somebody in the present? He must have somebody in the present because he's gaining from him. So again, it's based upon the gain. And if the gain ceases, so then it should be... and the friendship should cease. The only true friendship is the friendship between good people. No, I mean, well this friendship is definitely for my own benefit. This would be this case. Let's say, for instance, you have two friends that are friends because of pleasure or utility. And then they went off. One friend stayed in New York City, one friend went to Alaska. Right? So if the friendship was based upon the good, he would still remain your friend no matter how distant. If the friendship was based upon the utility, that's right, it would dissolve completely. Or if it was based upon pleasure, it would dissolve, it would cease to exist. You see? So, I mean, the question is, if you're going to tell me that in the case of pleasure, he's only interested in the pleasure, so why should we consider this friendship altogether? Elamai, I have to say there is some element of friendship here. It's an element of friendship, so why should it be different than the friendship of the good? You know what I mean? It seems at first sight to be a contradiction, because he's saying there is a friendship based upon pleasure, and then he says the only reason that I like the guy is because of the pleasure, in which case it's not a friendship. I mean, either it's a friendship, or else it's not a friendship. One of the two. If it's a friendship, so it's a friendship just like any other one, even like the friendship of the good. And if it's not a friendship, because it's based upon desire for pleasure and mutual exploitation, so then that's not friendship, so it shouldn't be classed as friend. You see? Right? Aristotle is saying an interesting phenomenon here. It's saying like this, that friendship can be promoted, friendship can be produced via three parts of the human psyche. Three parts can produce, of the human soul, three parts can produce friendship. It's an interesting thing. The utility part can produce friendship. The pleasure part of man can produce friendship. And also, the good in man can produce friendship. There are three types of friendships. Three routes through which friendship can be engendered. You see? That's what Aristotle says. To what exactly it is. But the fact that it's true, I don't think can be denied. In other words, you see people who are involved together in terms of utility, business partners, there is a certain friendship that's produced. I mean, under normal circumstances, of course, business partners can hate each other, but under normal circumstances, there is a certain friendship, a certain type of friendship that is engendered, is promoted here. You see? Then you see people who have mutual pleasure, also there's a type of friendship that's promoted. And among the good, there is also a friendship. So friendship could be brought about through three separate routes. What it is that friendship is at this point, we're not saying what it is. But that it is so is no question. Distinction between youth and old age is that in youth you look for pleasure, in old age you look for utility.
But that's why when people are young, they look at old people and they see their relationships and they scorn it, and they laugh at it, they deride it. Because they feel that, they're married for companionship, you see? Because the old people are interested in utility. So the young person's emotions can't conceive of it. Of course, these young people will one day be the same people as, and they'll also be interested in utility. Just like these people are interested in utility now, were at one time interested in pleasure. But the emotions are so powerful that at the time that you're under the grip of the emotion, you can't conceive that you will ever change, that you will be different. Because the emotion presents a reality, an absolute reality, even though it's so relative and transient, you see? So that's why you have the barrier between the youth and old age, because neither one can conceive the other one's type of life, and they speak as if it's absolutes, even though each one has or will undergo what the other one is presently undergoing. okay. Getting back to friendship. So what Aristotle says is that there are three routes to friendship. One is through utility, one is through pleasure, and one is through the good. Now, that if you take the root of utility, let's say, or the root of pleasure, so he says, by taking that root, you by definition, since you're taking that root, he says, the essence of the friendship is contingent upon the pleasure or the utility. So it's true that pleasure or utility does throw off, it does have a friendship to it. It has an attending friendship. But this friendship is totally contingent upon the thing that it's that produced it, which is the desire for utility or desire for friendship. That's a certain type of friendship, you see. It's produced by this element in man. Now, since it's produced and it's subservient and based upon this element, so therefore, if the person doesn't supply the pleasure or the utility, so the friendship dissolves. Because the whole friendship is via this element. And what is this element seeking? This element is seeking pleasure, right? Let's take the case of pleasure. So the element seeking pleasure. And the friendship is an offshoot of pleasure. Now therefore, the moment the friendship doesn't supply the pleasure, friendship has to dissolve. Because it's a pleasure friendship. See, the different elements produce different types of friendships. That's what Aristotle is saying. It's qualitatively three qualitative types of friendships. So there's a pleasure friendship, which means the element in us which seeks pleasure can also produce friendship. But the basic element is pleasure driven. So therefore, if the pleasure mechanism isn't receiving what it wants, the friendship is gone. The same thing with utility. If the utility element has the ability to create an offshoot of friendship, there is such a thing. It's a utility friendship, a different type of friendship. But basically, what's the underlying element seeking? The underlying element is seeking utility, correct? So now the utility is gone. So then the friendship. If the essence of the thing itself is gone, then certainly the offshoot is gone. So therefore, if the friendship is produced by utility, it's engendered by utility. The moment the utility ceases, that's the end of the friendship. You know what I mean? It has to be that way. Now let's take the case of the good.
What about
the good also has a has as an offshoot has a friendship. Has its respective friendship. Each element in the soul has its respective friendship. Now what about the friendship of the good? So we can understand. So how does the friendship of the good, why is it that by the friendship of the good we say it's for the sake of the person? Yes, here you need what the Aristotle says in the other place. That Aristotle says that the good man is the only man that can have a friend. Why? Because what is the good? The good man is a person who appreciates Aristotle says you are your own friend. See? Now, the good man is really his own friend because he appreciates and he enjoys a certain harmony in his own soul. He appreciates that. That's what the good man is basically an individual who appreciates who's in a frame of mind which is happy, and therefore he appreciates this state. You see, Now, when he sees another individual, he sees another soul that has that same, where his appreciation extends beyond him, beyond himself, to another individual, you see, so then a friendship arises. So a friendship arises through the fact that his appreciation for the harmony in his soul is extended to another individual. It's a certain appreciation of the good. See, what the friendship is, an appreciation. It's an appreciation of the good. So in the case of the good man, since he appreciates the good in himself, and he sees another individual that is also good, so there's an extension of his appreciation. So therefore, he appreciates the individual. Therefore, it's related to the essence of the individual, because it's an appreciation of the essence of the other person. Whereas in the case of pleasure, in the case of pleasure, there is no appreciation. He doesn't appreciate. Can you say in the friendship of pleasure that I appreciate the element in the other person that arouses him to pleasure? What do I care about that? I mean, what do I care? If the relationship is basically pleasure driven, so what do I care about I'm not concerned with the element in the other person that gives rise to his pleasure. I mean, it's true there is a friendship, there's a certain camaraderie because we share something, but it's not an appreciation of anything within him. You follow what I mean? Same thing with utility also. With utility, there is no appreciation. The nature of the friendship of the good, what Aristotle is saying is like this: the nature of the friendship of the good is an appreciation of the goodness. Because why does the good man need a friend? What does he enjoy in a friend? He appreciates the goodness that this friend reflects. You see? Now, it's not for the purpose of utility or for the purpose of pleasure, because anyone who is driven by those motives is not the good. So the good man is only driven by one type of motivation. It's an appreciation of the good. That's what drives him. He appreciates the good. Now, since he appreciates the good, that is his nature. When he sees the good in somebody else, he appreciates that good as well. Now, since he appreciates that good, he's related inherently to the essence of the person, and he really likes the person. So that even if the person should travel away, even the person on the other side, he still has that appreciation. When he thinks of that individual, there's a certain appreciation that goes along with it. You see? Whereas in the case of the friendship based upon pleasure, there is no appreciation. A person who is a friend, who is seeking pleasure, a person is essentially a pleasure seeker, and he relates to another pleasure seeker. Would you say he appreciates the fine element that the other person has in the seeking pleasure? I mean, what is he? It's absurd. There is nothing to appreciate. There's nothing to admire. What's there to appreciate? What the Aristotle was, where he says that the friendship that's based upon pleasure is not a real is not a real friendship. He's not interested in the friend. He's only interested in the pleasure, right? And yet the friendship that's based upon goodness, it would seem, is he's interested in the person himself. I mean, what's the difference? Why don't I say by goodness he's interested in the good, and by pleasure he's interested in the pleasure? What difference does it make, right? That was a difficulty. It seems like almost inescapable. Right? Works is as follows. The thing is like this, that friendship really is, what is it? We have to give a definition to friendship. Friendship is something, is the way a person feels, the feelings, the emotions that a person has towards another individual that exists within his environment. You see? Within his environment. That's the way. That's what the friendship is. Now there are different frameworks, there are different environments. In other words, there's an environment of pleasure. There's an environment of utility. Now, why does Aristotle break friendship down to three types of friendships? Three, because every friendship, since friendship is the way you feel towards an individual who is within a given framework, there are really only three human frameworks. First, human framework is utility. Next is pleasure, and then there is the good. There's only three human frameworks, right? So therefore, there will be as many friends as you have human frameworks. Okay? Now, friendship is always, again, the feeling that you have towards a person who is within one of these frameworks. Right? Okay. Now, Aristotle is like this. That let's say, for instance, you take the framework of pleasure. So within the framework of pleasure, you will
encounter another human being who's necessary for your pleasure, and you'll feel kindly disposed towards him. Right? And that's friendship. That's what friendship is. So he says, yes, that's true. But that's, and that's why he calls it friendship. That's why he calls it friendship. Well, so he also had another question. Why is it called a friendship if he says you're only interested in the pleasure? So that shouldn't be friendship at all. The answer is because you do feel kindly disposed towards this individual who is within the framework of pleasure. But what Aristotle says is, since the basis of the whole framework is pleasure, that's the whole basis of the framework, so the friendship cannot exceed the framework within which it finds itself. So therefore, the nature of the friendship is restricted to pleasure, right? Because that's the framework within which it exists. So it has to be restricted to pleasure. Now, since that is the case, you cannot relate to, even though you feel kindly disposed towards this individual, but it cannot go deeper than the framework within which it exists. So therefore, you only feel kindly disposed to him insofar as he supplies you with pleasure. You see? The good, you see, again, in the realm of the good, in the framework of the good, you'll come across different individuals, and you'll come across somebody that you'll find you enjoy the good with, right? Okay, now, friendship means you'll feel a certain emotion towards this person, you'll feel again kindly disposed towards this individual because he is involved with you in seeking for the good, right? But over here, there's one difference. The difference is like this. Since, insofar as the good is concerned, you have to be dealing with his essence, so his essence becomes involved. So therefore, there's an attachment to his essence. See, in the framework of the good, only in the framework of the good can there be an attachment to the essence. Because in the framework of the good, it's the only place where you're dealing with the guy's essence. In the framework of pleasure, so you feel kindly disposed towards this individual who is part of your pleasure scene. Yeah, but only insofar as he supplies you with pleasure. It's true there are feelings. The reason why Aristotle calls it a friend is because it's the same phenomena. There are certain feelings towards that individual, you see. But since it's by definition it's within the pleasure framework, so its nature is determined by the pleasure framework. So therefore you're only related to the individual insofar as he supplies you with pleasure. Right? Whereas in the framework of the good, you are related to his essence, because in the framework of the good you have to deal with his essence. His essence must come into the picture. So therefore there is a real appreciation of his essence. The only time you have an appreciation of the essence is in the framework of the good. You'll never have an appreciation of his essence within the other two frameworks, utility or pleasure. Because the friendship has to be restricted to the framework that it operates in. And in the framework, it's only recognizing this individual insofar as he's part of the framework, which means insofar as his utility, insofar as his pleasure. So therefore, inherently, you can't be related to his essence. The only framework within which the essence comes into view is the framework of the good. You see? That's why that's the only friendship. That's why Aristotle classifies, it's no contradiction, he classifies them all as friends, because it's all the same phenomena. There's a certain feeling. The definition is a feeling which is evoked by one human being towards another when he finds him as part of his framework. That's what it is. You see, that's the definition of friendship. So you have that in three different frameworks. But the nature of the framework restricts the relationship itself, or has an effect on the relationship itself. If it's the good, so then of course there's no restriction, because then you're relating to the essence of the other individual. But where it's pleasure or where it's utility, the nature of the framework is restrictive. So therefore, you only relate to the individual insofar as he supplies you with pleasure. So that's why it's inherently, that's why he says we really shouldn't even call this friendship. So then what does he count this friendship for? He means we shouldn't call it friendship because the framework is so restrictive that friendship almost becomes obliterated. Although the phenomena presents itself in the same manner as it does in the good. So technically speaking, we have to call it friendship. But insofar as friendship per se is concerned, it really doesn't partake too much of friendship. You see? Okay? Why the phenomena is such that a person develops feelings towards another human being, you see, in his environment or in his framework, that's a psychological phenomenon. Aristotle's not talking about that. That's psychology. But the fact is, but when we want to define philosophically what friendship is, that's what friendship is. Now he's showing you that the framework itself affects the nature of the friendship. It's an unbelievable idea. Okay, chapter 3, he states this very clearly.
Therefore, those who love for the sake of utility love for the sake of what is good for themselves, and those who love for the sake of pleasure do so for the sake of what is pleasant to themselves, and not in so far as the other is the person loved, but in so far as he is useful or pleasant.
See, there, that's what he's saying. He's saying the framework itself really determines how much of the concept of friendship could be experienced there. Because if it's restricted to the pleasure, pleasure framework, so then by definition you really can't have any love for the person himself, because you have no relationship to the person himself. Whereas where you're dealing with the good, that's where the person himself comes into the picture. It becomes clear why there are only three types of friends. Because the definition that Aristotle is working with, and the same one the Rambam, of course, because the Rambam mentions the three types of friends, is that friendship is the feelings that we have towards another human being who exists within our framework. That's what it is. In the situation of the good, I was just being repetitive, but in the situation of the good, the friend, the essence of the man comes into view. Now this thing, this kinship, this emotion that we have towards individuals who are part of our framework can relate itself to the essence of the man, you see? And therefore you have a real friendship. Aristotle isn't going into the psychology of why it is that way. That's a different thing. That's the way people are. We can't deny that's the way people are. I mean, a lot of various people. Aristotle can't investigate everything at once. That's a different point, psychologically, how it works. But the fact is that exists, that this emotion exists, you see, and Aristotle considers it a good emotion, a valuable emotion, a good one. So we have to put it in its proper perspective and benefit from it. That's what he maintains. Say is an ex. It exists as an accident in a framework. You see, man has feelings of kinship or friendship, but the only time that the man will appear is in the framework of the good. Once he makes his appearance, now these feelings of kinship will attach themselves to that essence. How does this? Also, by the way, that's why Aristotle says it speaks in terms of whether friendships are enduring or not. That's another aspect. So he says the pleasures, since the pleasures change, are more changeable, so even this friendship itself, which per se isn't real friendship, but nevertheless, you see, it's very subject to change, right? It's not enduring, right? Whereas the friendship which involves the good is a very enduring friendship, because the good... One who desires the good doesn't usually change. The good man doesn't change. Another point, too. The point is this, that the pleasures change. What do you mean the pleasures change? You'll say, but yeah, but it's true, the pleasures change. But the fact is, the man will not change from his search for pleasures. Right? He's still pleasure-seeking. He's always... As a matter of fact, that seems to be even more enduring, or at least just as enduring, as the people who are seeking the good. People who are seeking pleasures seem not to change either. Like this. The answer is, it's true, the individual abstractly is searching for pleasure and doesn't change from that. See? Very hard to dissuade him from that single-minded objective, right. But the thing is, in the world of pleasure, he changes from one pleasure to another. See, there are many pleasures. And that's why he keeps changing his friends. But there's only one good. See, the good is one. And the reason is because he who is searching after pleasures is searching after physical experiences. Physical experiences are separated. You see, but he who is searching after the good is searching after some abstract essence. That abstract essence is one. See, it's not many. Good
by the good is only one. There aren't many goods. There's only one good for man. Of course, you'll say that the one who seeks pleasure also seeks after his pleasure seeking. Yeah. It's true, he's seeking pleasure. But in his search for pleasure, he has to be involved in many pleasures. So therefore, each time he switches from one pleasure to another, he switches his friends, because he's switching, he's changing his environment, you see? Whereas he who is searching for the good, he who is in search of the good, never switches. He's after the one good, and he's always involved in searching for that good, and there's never any change. Yes? That's a good point. Yeah. Another point was mentioned is that in pleasure, inherently you're going to be searching for one, you're going to be changing. Because pleasure is based upon a certain fantasy. And the fantasy wears off, so you have to change to the next. That's why you always have changing styles. And that's why you always have different sports come into fashion at different times. Because after a while, it wears out. You know, the fantasy wears out. So now you have to start over, or start the fantasy over again with another sport, with another activity. You see, another pleasure. So pleasures, by definition, by nature, have to keep on changing. Therefore, the friendships must keep on changing. It's more than just that they do change. They have to change. Whereas the good, he who is searching for the good, I mean, it is impossible that he should change. What is he going to change for? There's no other good. This is the good. He's searching for something that exists in reality in one manner, and there is no change involved. And is, how does this stand with regard to the other piece of Aristotle that we mentioned before? Which is, Aristotle says that the only one that can have a friend is the good man. Only the good man can have a friend, he says. How does this new information stand with regard to the what he mentioned before? Yeah. Like this. That insofar as this, what Aristotle's doing right now, is he's classifying the friendships. What he's doing, but what we did before, and Aristotle it's later, he is showing, once we have the different classes of friendships, now he's going into friendship per se, that kinship per se. And he shows that that's only, that concept is only truly possible. You see, it can only truly be fulfilled completely by an individual who has a certain frame of mind. You see. In other words, there is such an entity as friendship, and friendship exists, we said, on these three levels. Right? Even though, of course, the levels exclude the friendship by definition, or limit, restrict the friendship. True. But there is such a thing, apparently, as friendship existing in these three levels, right? Now he's analyzing friendship per se. And he says, what is friendship? What is this emotion, or this kinship? What is this? What kind of a thing is it? And he says that it stems from an appreciation of the self. So he says, therefore, it can only exist in the good man to the fullest. Because only the good man has an appreciation of himself. He says, where does a person learn friendship from? Where does the experience begin from? Begins, you are your own friend. That's where it begins. Now this, so therefore, since it starts with the appreciation of the self, he says only the good man appreciates himself. Because he's the only one that's happy when he's the only one that's at peace with himself and can truly be happy being alone because he appreciates himself. And since he appreciates himself, so then he could, when he sees another soul that he is involved with in friendship, he can appreciate that other individual also. See, now he's going into the basis of friendship, of what friendship is per se. Before he's just categorizing what the friendships are. See, what the definition of friendship is. Now he's going into, in other words, it shows it exists in three different frameworks. Now he's showing you what that thing which exists in three different frameworks, where it comes from. You see? And he shows you the only one that really is subject to it, to the fullest, is really the good man. Of course, there's different degrees. I mean, it's not just that the good man is the only one that has this thing, because apparently everybody has friends. But he shows you that the good man is the only one that can really experience it and appreciate it to the fullest. You see? The only one that is really subject to the highest degree to the phenomenon of friendship.
Well, how could this
evil man that has no place to get it from to begin with. Is like this, is there are two types of love of the self. One love of the self is a desire to satiate your own needs and your wants. That everybody has, the good man and the evil man alike. But there is another thing, an appreciation of the self. That only the good man can have, because only the good man is at peace with himself. And only he who is at peace with himself can appreciate himself.
And Aristotle says that true friendship is an extension of that appreciation to somebody else. That can only exist with a good man. The evil man is always torn. You ask me a question, though, a bank robber, after he pulls off a heist, so he's very happy with himself. Yeah, but that's only a momentary thing. It's only a momentary experience. Basically, he's very unhappy, because a few hours later, he's going to be in a state of desire for the next bank job. You see, in a state of dissatisfaction for the fact that he doesn't have enough, he didn't achieve enough, he didn't gain enough from what he did. So he's basically a person, in other words, a person cannot really be considered happy with himself. Just like, for instance, if a person would have a relationship, let's say a person would have a dog, and the dog would be good once a day, but it would be torturous, it would be troublesome the rest of the day. How would he feel towards this dog? Would he feel appreciation for this dog or not? He would judge the dog by how he performs most of the time. So therefore, the evil man, most of the time, is very unhappy. So he really hates himself. So basically, he's dissatisfied with himself and he hates himself. A person will develop feelings towards himself insofar as the self is satisfying him, as he appreciates himself most of the time, based on most of the time. Can't go by one instant. The person will have a dog that is good once a week. So he's going to like this dog, he's going to hate it. You see? That's the same thing with the self. Therefore, only the good man can have an appreciation, a true appreciation of himself. If a person is totally evil, then the only friend, he would not have anything that we'd really call friendship. He would just appear to others as a friend in order to make use of them. But in reality, he'd have no feelings of friendship. A good man's experience of friendship is the highest on two counts. First of all, because he relates to an essence in another individual. And secondly, he's capable of the quality of the feeling is different. Because since he's a good man, so he has this appreciation, and he can have the appreciation in somebody else. It's a totally different type of experience. It's a different type of friendship experience, actually, the good man. It's qualitatively differentiated, not just in terms of the object. Appreciation of perfection in another individual. That's avashant liyabadava. That we have are friendships which we, even if we think about it, will sense there are certain demands in the friendship. When you think of the friend, there's a certain need that he's satisfying. How many people really have a friendship that they appreciate a certain perfection in a certain individual? That's a different kind of experience. Qualitatively,